Thank you. Thanks, operator. Welcome, everybody. Sorry about all the instructions, but this is the only way we can get so many people from so many places together, and it's worked very well for us over the years. So welcome to all of you on behalf of Kaiser and HRET. With me today is Dr. Ken Anderson from our longtime partners at HRET and Gary Claxton, who has so ably led this project for so many years, and Matthew Holt from Kaiser, who's been lead analyst on this project now for a very long time. As usual, what we're going to do today is spotlight the key findings and answer your questions as quickly as we can get to them. You should have a press release and a chart pack, and there's a fat report online with a chapter on pretty much everything about employer-based health insurance, and there's a very good web summary published in Health Affairs, which is available on their website. They really also are now a pretty long-term partner in this project. This is, amazingly, our 18th annual employer health benefits survey. I would say that with all the attention that goes to the ACA and lately mostly to the marketplaces in the ACA, I think it's just useful to remember that there are 150 million, roughly, people who get their coverage through employer-based insurance, through the employer-based system we are reporting on today. So it's by far the single largest part of the health insurance system, and it really matters. And I'm going to start by asking Dr. Ken Anderson, who's the chief operating officer from our partner at HRET, to offer an introduction, then a few comments, as I do every year from me. Then you'll hear from Gary and Matthew, who will just focus really on a few key findings from this very large survey, and we'll open it up to questions. So Dr. Anderson, Ken, floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Drew. Good morning, everyone. My name is Dr. Ken Anderson. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at Health Research and Educational Trust of the American Hospital Association. As Drew said, this is the 18th year that we've been a part of this survey, and we've been very proud to be a part of the survey, which is a great resource to help us better understand what's going on with the healthcare system. On behalf of HRET, I want to thank the Kaiser staff for pulling together and releasing this very important report. I intend to be brief with my comments so that those that are most steeped in the survey results can really go in depth from the findings of this report. But a couple of findings really jumped out at me that as I reviewed them in this year's results, and I wanted to share those with you. These, I believe, do speak to the changes that we're seeing in the nation's healthcare system. Overall, it's really been a pretty quiet year for coverage and premium changes in employer-sponsored plans. Coverage continued to increase based on organizational size, but there were really no significant difference from previous years. There has been stability in the employer market, and that continues despite some initial projections that public health insurance marketplaces might erode private coverage. In addition, over the last 2 years, there's been a trend from PPO plans to high deductible plans. With finding that as PPO rates declined from 58% to 48% of the survey respondents, high deductible health plan increased from 21 to 29% of respondents. And I think this illustrates the continued strategy that some employers are using to shift the financial burden to employees. The good news is that employers continue to focus on wellness and prevention programs, things such as smoking cessation, weight loss programs, lifestyle coaching, all designed to help employees manage their own healthcare costs. In fact, if you look at the survey results, 14% of large employers are providing incentives for their employees to meet key biometric targets such as weight, body mass, cholesterol levels, and normalization of blood pressure. In addition, large employers are providing coverage through retail clinics and through telemedicine. And this illustrates the changing nature of our complex healthcare system. There's been a shift from the traditional model of care to one that goes beyond the four walls of the hospital. And that's one in which our field continues to embrace. So at the present time, I wanted to give my thanks again to Kaiser for the support and for you, the audience today, for taking the time to listen in on what has been a long-standing and important survey. So at the present time, I'll turn it back over to Drew and his team, who can go deeper into the full survey results and address questions that you may have. Drew?
All right. Ken, thank you very much. We will talk more about all those issues and try and kind of also get to what they mean. So just a few comments from me, as you get every year. First of all, this year's survey shows that premium growth remains low, and really strikingly low if you've been watching this for as long as I have by historical standards. And as Ken said, that high deductible health plans with and without savings accounts continue to grow while conventional PPO plans decline in terms of market share. And, you know, from my perspective, what we're really seeing this year, but we've seen it develop gradually, is a shift in what insurance is for most Americans, from more comprehensive to skimpier coverage with more skin in the game. It's most pronounced in employers with less than 200 employees, which in the survey we call smaller employers. It's both good and bad, and we can talk about that. And I think it's the biggest change in healthcare in America that we are not really debating. It may even be more important than the ACA in terms of the number of people affected. And we know from our polling, our regular other polling at Kaiser, that the issue of rising out-of-pocket costs for deductibles and also for drug prices is a much higher priority for the public than the politically much hotter ACA is. We see in the survey that deductibles are rising much faster than premiums, almost six times faster than wages. One striking number to me, the average deductible now for those smaller firms, employers with less than 200 employees, is now $2,000 a year for people who do have a deductible. In general, smaller firms are struggling more to provide family coverage, and generally throughout the survey, there just are real differences between smaller and larger firms on a number of key measures, and Gary and Matthew will show you some of that. Whether high deductible health plans are a good thing or a bad thing is a question without a simple answer. They're cheaper, they're likely good for some people and bad for other people. Our analysis shows they've helped to hold premium growth down. They're one of the reasons why we're seeing the very slow growth in premiums we're seeing, and we will go through that. There are also, to me, at least two big things to say about the ACA from this survey. One is, it's clearly not driven up employer health costs because they could not reasonably be expected to be growing much more slowly than they are. And that's one criticism that you hear a lot in the supercharged debate about the ACA. And secondly, there's no evidence of employers shifting workers to part-time status because of the law. We're just not seeing that. In fact, to the extent we're seeing shifts, and they're very small, they're in the other direction. And finally, as Ken said, there's a lot of employer interest in health risk assessments and biometric screening and some interest in incentives to do it, as we will show you. And wellness programs themselves have become a big industry, and that is also a big issue now in healthcare, and there are real questions we can discuss about the evidence surrounding effectiveness, and we may get into that to some degree as well as you ask your questions. So with that kind of brief introduction of what to me are some of the more salient big picture points, I'll turn it over to Gary and then to Matthew. So Gary, go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to speak with you about the results of our 2016 survey. Can we go through a couple slides further? Thanks. Before I start, I'd like to thank Greg Foster and Heidi Whitmore, who were colleagues at HRET and NORC, for their assistance and all their hard work, and we really appreciate it. So starting with the first slide, our general finding is that the average single premium for workers with employer-sponsored coverage is $6,145 in 2016, and the average premium for family coverage is $18,142. As Drew said, the 2016 average family premium is 3% higher than the 2015 average. The 2015 to 2016 change for the average single premium is not statistically significant. Next slide, please. I think as also was pointed out, we're in a period of low growth for premiums. The average family premium grew 20% over the last 5 years. That's less than the 31% and the 63% growth for the previous 2 5-year periods. Next slide, please. Since we started the survey in 1999, family premiums have increased 213% and worker contributions have increased 242%. Both premiums and contributions have increased substantially more than inflation and workers' earnings over the period. Next slide. The average single premiums for workers in small and large firms are similar for single coverage. You can see that on the left-hand side. The average family premiums for workers in large firms are higher than the average family premiums for workers in small firms. In contrast, workers in small firms have a lower average contribution than workers in large firms, but a higher for single coverage, sorry, but a higher average contribution for family coverage. Next slide. On average, workers in small, on average, workers contribute about 18% of the cost of single coverage and about 30% of the cost of family coverage. These amounts have been stable over the recent past. There is substantial variation around these averages, however, which is reported in the report and in the summary of findings. Next slide. As Ken noted, the share of covered workers enrolled in high deductible plans with a savings option, either a health reimbursement arrangement or a health savings account, has increased 8 percentage points over the last 2 years. At the same time, the share of workers covered who are enrolled in PPO plans has fallen 10 percentage points. I think that this slide shows some of the reason. The average single premiums for single, the average single premiums and family premiums for workers in high deductible plans with savings options are lower than the overall single and family average premiums. As Drew noted, the shift in enrollment to these lower cost plans has reduced the rate of premium increase by about a half percentage point each of the last 2 years. Next slide. As always, we have a few slides in the report on deductibles. Not because they're the only type of cost sharing, but because they're the most visible and evident to people. 83% of covered workers are in a plan with a general annual deductible in 2016, similar to the percentage last year. Having a general annual deductible means that you have to pay the deductible before the plan will pay towards most services. The average deductible for single coverage for workers in a plan with a general annual deductible is $1,478, up from $1,318 last year. If we were to assign a zero as the deductible for workers in plans without a general annual deductible, the average deductible for all covered workers is $1,221 in 2016, which is up from $10,077 last year. As Drew noted, the growth in deductibles has been significant over the last 5 years. They've increased 63% for single coverage deductibles, which is much faster than the growth in premiums, wages, or inflation. Another way to look at deductibles is the percent of covered workers with a deductible of at least $1,000. About half of covered workers are enrolled in a plan with a general annual deductible of $1,000 or more, including 65% of workers in small firms. As we noted, as we talked about above, there's been a substantial shift in enrollment to high deductible health plans with savings options. In most cases, workers in these plans actually receive contributions to their HRA or HSA accounts to help offset the cost sharing in these plans. One way of looking at what these contributions mean is if we apply the contribution or the account contribution to these worker, that these workers receive against the deductible that they face, it reduces the share of workers facing a deductible of at least $1,000, particularly in large firms. Overall, it's from 51% to 38%. As this slide shows how the account contributions compare to the deductible for workers and overall in high deductible plans with savings options. For about 9%, the account contribution is at least equal to their deductible, and for an additional 34%, the account contribution would reduce the remaining deductible liability below $1,000. This is just a this is sort of a shorthand way of looking at it. Workers don't always apply their account contributions to their deductibles, but cost sharing in plans is fairly complicated, and this is just one simple way to show some of the impact of the contributions. Turning now to offer rates, 56% of firms offer health benefits to at least some of their workers in 2016, which is similar to the rates over the last few years. As you'll see, if you look through our summary of findings, the offer rate for firms with 10 to 49 workers fell over the last 5 years from 74% to 66%. This is consistent with trends that we see from other sources and also looking at longer term trends. We are releasing a separate paper today, which is on our website, which looks at these trends over a longer period of time. Among workers in firms that offer and that both offer and don't offer health benefits, about 55% of the covered workers are about 55% of covered workers are covered by benefits at their own job, which is similar to last year, but a reduction from 58% in 2011. Workers in small firms are much less likely to be covered at their own job than workers in large firms. Matthew's going to talk about the remaining slides.
Next slide. Virtually all large firms which offer health benefits offer coverage to spouses and other dependents. In addition, 49% of large firms offering health benefits extend coverage to same-sex domestic partners, and 42% offer coverage to opposite-sex domestic partners. While most offering firms extend coverage to spouses and dependents, some firms have financial incentives to influence employees' enrollment decisions. 13% of firms offering spousal coverage do not allow spouses to enroll if they are eligible for coverage from another source, and another 5% allow spouses to enroll only under some conditions. Of the firms that allow spouses to enroll, 12% ask employees to make an additional premium contribution if they are offered coverage from another source. 10% of firms offering health benefits have financial incentives for employees who elect to enroll in a spouse's plan. Many firms, particularly small firms, do not make any additional financial contribution to family coverage. 45% of small firms make the same dollar contribution regardless of whether the employee enrolled in single coverage or family coverage. This means that workers are required to cover the entire additional cost of enrolling any dependents, which may be a financial burden for many households. Slide. Employers continue to show considerable interest in health promotion programs, including health screenings such as health risk assessments and biometric screening. Some employers have financial incentives tied to whether employees participate in or complete programs. About a third of large offering firms have financial incentives for employees to complete biometric screening, health risk assessments, or wellness programs. In addition, 8% of large firms offering health benefits have an incentive for employees to meet biometric outcomes, such as a targeted BMI or cholesterol level. About half of large firms offering health benefits have an incentive for any of the health screening or health promotion programs we ask about. There's considerable variation in the size of the incentive that employers offer. Looking at the value of all of these incentives together, 26% of firms have an incentive of $150 or less, and 7% have an incentive of $2,000 or more. Now looking at the so-called Cadillac tax, starting in 2020, employer health plans will be subject to an excise tax of 40% on the amount by which their total costs exceed specified thresholds. Almost two-thirds of large offering employers have conducted an analysis to determine whether their health benefits will exceed these limits. Smaller percentage of large firms have already taken actions, such as increasing cost-sharing or switching to lower-cost health plans. The excise tax on high-cost health plans was initially slated to take effect in 2018, but was delayed last year. Among those large offering firms which have conducted an analysis, 31% said that the delay caused them to postpone or reconsider changes. Just over a quarter of these employers believe that their largest plan will exceed the thresholds in 2020. Now turning to the employer mandate. The employer shared responsibility provision of the ACA requires that employers with 50 or more full-time equivalents offer employees and their dependents coverage which meets standards for affordability and minimum value, or potentially face penalties. In 2016, the vast majority of offering firms with 50 or more full-time equivalents offered coverage which met these standards. We asked employers what sort of changes they were making in response to the implementation of the shared responsibility provision. 12% of offering firms with 50 or more FTEs extended eligibility to workers that were not previously eligible. Interestingly, more firms subject to the employer mandate converted part-time positions into full-time positions so that employees would become eligible than did the opposite, converting full-time jobs into part-time jobs. Now thinking about private exchanges. These exchanges are typically established by consulting companies and allow employers to offer a range of health benefits to their employees. In 2016, 2% of covered workers at firms with 50 or more employees are covered through such an arrangement. Employers continue to incorporate alternative care settings into their plans, including almost 3/4 of large employers which cover care at retail clinics. In addition, we asked employers of the scope of their networks. 7% of firms offering health benefits offer at least one plan they consider a narrow network plan. The plan with the largest enrollment at almost 4 in 10 large firms includes coverage for care delivered by providers at a remote location. Among these firms, 1/3 of employers have financial incentives to encourage employees to seek care through telemedicine rather than visiting a physician's office in person. Recently, there's been considerable interest in specialty drugs. Specialty drugs are typically high-cost drugs, and while most employer plans cover them, many large employers are doing things to contain the cost, including step therapies and utilization management programs.
And I think now we're done presenting the slides and are available for questions.
Yeah, no, except Matthew didn't present the last slide, which is our logos. And of course, our logo is there and says all the wrong things because it features Kaiser, whom we're not connected to, and Family Foundation. We're neither a foundation or a family foundation. So offline, I'd be happy to have your suggestions about logo redesign. Yes, we're very we're absolutely ready to go to questions. Thanks.
Okay, our first question is from Steve Jordan of the Omaha World Herald. Please comment on the contrast between the 3.4% increase in premiums for employer groups found by the survey and the high premium increases we have seen for individual policies through the Affordable Care Act.
There's a question we didn't expect to get. I'm happy to take it, but Gary, why don't you start on that?
Sure. In those two cases, what the premiums are, what the premium changes are measuring are pretty different things. The premiums in the employer market it's a stable market, and they're related to the underlying changes in healthcare costs, and with a little bit of reduction in the value of the benefits from year to year, because of the higher cost sharing. The places that have high premium increases in the marketplace, in the public marketplaces, the high increases are because the premiums for prior years were insufficient to cover the morbidity of the people enrolled. Very little of those of the high level for the high level premium increases, very little of it's actually associated with healthcare cost trend. It's about getting the pricing to the correct level. Also, because the way the actuarial value provisions work, there's not as much of a change in value from year to year, so you don't really get to reduce premium trends based on changes in the value of the benefits. But it's primarily about repricing, about getting the prices right from prior prices which were not correct.
Okay. Our second question is from Chris Vanderbeen of KUSA-TV. The question is, well, actually two questions. Is the slowdown in premium increases related to the increase in cost sharing through higher deductibles? I'll go ahead and let you all answer that question before I move on to the second question.
Yeah, this is Drew. I mean, there's, you know, considerable debate in the field about the reasons for the slowdown in health costs generally, whether you're talking about overall health spending, or in this study we're looking at premiums. My own view is the two major factors are still the sluggish recovery, which very, very recently appears to be picking up a little bit, and the increases in cost sharing, both of which depress utilization of health services. They have precisely the same effect. And we actually documented, as Gary said, the effect that the impact in cost sharing has had on premium growth in the last 2 years in this study. There are other developments going on in the health system that may or may not, changes in payment, changes in delivery, be having some effect on cost growth. And there are debates about how much those changes are having an impact, if in fact they are. But I personally think the two biggest factors, it's plausible that all of the above are, two biggest factors are still the slow recovery and increases in cost sharing. Gary, do you want to add anything to that?
Just that as cost sharing has gone up, it's increasing from higher and higher levels, and so people are facing substantial out-of-pocket costs. And that seems to be keeping utilization down, like Drew said.
And the second question from Chris is about high deductible health plans. Is there a way to gauge how many employees only have a high deductible plan as an option?
Good question.
We have information about firms that's the only type of plan that they offer. We don't necessarily know if every one of their employees has that offer or not. It's Exhibit 4.5 in the materials, which you can get. They're available now,
yeah.
Online. And there's some explanation there of how we do that.
A guess would be, though, that it would be a fair number of smaller employers for whom that's the option, but I don't have a number.
This is Ken Anderson. I just wanted to sound off a little bit in the point that that we heard earlier related to what Drew was saying about system-based changes. I think that we've also seen some right-sizing of utilization that's beginning to arise from the systematic deployment of electronic health records that incorporate clinical decision support and providing just-in-time information about diagnostic and therapeutic options. Large-scale movements from some of our other research that we're doing at HRET that demonstrates care quality and safety is being enhanced, both which are the systematic side of right-sizing some of the utilization as well.
Okay, so we have two questions about more localized data. The first one is a straightforward question. Do you guys have any state-by-state data? And then the second question is, did the survey find any regional differences in cost, Midwest, Coast, et cetera?
There are. I don't remember if there are regional differences in premiums, but someone's looking right now. While they're looking for that, I can say in answer to the previous question, about 30% of workers work for a firm that only offers a high deductible health plan with a savings option of covered workers. Do we have a region?
Just a south of
lower. Lower. For regional coverage, in terms of premiums, the premiums in the South are lower for both single and family coverage when compared to the other regions. We didn't find any other differences.
Sorry, just to confirm, that's for family coverage, but not for single coverage.
Well, you're right. It's monthly and annual.
Okay. Next question from Chris Snowbeck. is there a way to compare the total premium for families in employer plans versus the total cost that families are paying on the exchanges?
Hey, Chris. I think the answer to that, if you mean total exposure to premium and out-of-pocket costs, I don't think we have that information. We can use some other data to try to come up with some look at what people are actually paying out-of-pocket from other types of information we have, but not from this survey.
And he had another question, perhaps following up. To what extent is the pain for families on the exchanges a function of premiums being high in absolute terms versus the fact that they must pay the full freight versus families in employer plans that only cover part of the bill? Share of premium they must pay being so high.
I think the pain for families in exchanges is first and foremost a function of subsidies and whether they have them and how big they are. And, you know, as you all know, most people get them, some people don't, some people get a partial subsidy, and people who buy off the marketplaces but still in the non-group market are not eligible for them. Would you answer that differently, Gary?
No, I would answer it just like that, but I might add that the people who don't get offered coverage at work have much lower incomes than the people who do. So the folks who are on the exchanges who are facing the premiums generally have lower incomes. Some of them, as Drew said, get assistance, but others don't. The assistance runs out for some of them, especially younger workers, you know, below 400% of poverty because of the way the premiums work. And some of them still face substantial cost sharing. So there are different reasons why there's burden in the exchanges, in part because it's a lower income population.
Okay, I think we have a question on the phone now, operator.
And our first question comes from the line of James Unland with the Journal of Healthcare Finance.
My compliments to your entire team. This is a fabulous project each year, and I know a lot of work goes into this. Here's my question. I'm hearing more from providers, a lot more, about the accounts receivable that actually represent payables by consumers, as you all know. And some providers are starting to think about financing these receivables with the consumers directly. Now, I know you didn't survey providers, but my question is, are there any of the companies that you're working with respect to higher copays and deductibles, doing any work in this area to provide financing to help people pay off these amounts, which in actual dollars are now quite high? Thank you in advance for your time.
Yeah, this is Gary. I'm not aware that they are. To the extent they're insurers, I'm not sure that they would want to. I'm sure some employers have assistance programs, but it's not something we've asked about. It's an interesting thing maybe we could ask about. Thank you.
Next question is from Sarah Chaco. Hi there. Regarding the firms that say they have conducted analysis on the Cadillac tax, that's something Kaiser reported last year too. Were those the only 2 years that info was reported? I didn't see small firms mentioned in last year's report, but I wasn't sure if they weren't surveyed or simply not mentioned.
We did ask small firms about how they were responding to the Cadillac tax, and I believe there's more information on that in the full report. Typically, we look at the large firms because there's some more precision around those estimates, and also there's more covered workers, more people are enrolled in those plans at those firms.
And many fewer small firms said that they did the analysis. So there wasn't much to work with there, if I remember.
So looking at all, there's about 17% of all firms have conducted analysis. So there's just money, not very many relatively small firms have conducted analysis already.
We have a couple of follow-up questions. One from Steve Jordan. Can you relate the relative health of the employer groups versus the individuals who sign up through the APA marketplaces?
I think this is still, I think the question that you're asking really is the, it's symbolic of what's going on in the marketplaces. There was an assumption by a lot of insurers early on in the marketplaces and setting premiums that the coverage, that the basic average health level in the marketplaces would be similar to the, basically the small employer market. And it's not, and it's possible, and it looks like it's actually a little bit less healthy than the small employer market. But as enrollment grows, it's also changing over time, because as enrollment grows, it should be getting better. And that sort of instability in the early years, or lack of ability to estimate the real costs in the marketplaces, is the reason that the premiums have been less stable in some places. They've worked out fine in others. And so I think that's a question that's still being answered, but my belief is that they'll be slightly less healthy event, you know, when it all shakes out, because you have part of the reason people leave jobs is because they get sick and they can't work. So there is a systemic movement of people with less good health from employer insurance into the marketplaces. They used to go to COBRA, some still do, but now they can also go to the marketplaces. That's a long answer, but.
Okay, next, another follow-up from Chris Vanderveen. Want to make sure I heard correctly. Is there no good way to gauge out-of-pocket healthcare cost increases for employees, deductibles, and premiums, and how it's changing over time?
Yes, there is. I mean, one way you can look at the survey here to look at what the amount that they face, and that's what the survey is good at. We've released another paper few months ago looking at information from a large database of private sector employers, where we showed the amounts that employees pay out of pocket towards deductibles and co-payments and co-insurance, and how that's changing over time. And if someone gives us a call afterwards, we will certainly set them up with a survey. I don't have the link in my head.
Okay, this is Drew. And there are lots of ways to think about this and look at it, but I always believe it's important to look at it, too, in the context of what's happening with wages, which is why we have that chart in there. Because the pain level for people goes way up or way down, depending upon what's happening with their incomes. And that's why we have that chart that shows that deductibles are rising 5 or 6 times faster than people's wages have been rising. And that's why they feel the pain of the increases they have been experiencing year after year in cost sharing, you know, more than they otherwise would if we'd been living in a period of robust wage growth, which they have not been living in. So there are a variety of ways to look at it, but I always, as part of the analysis, emphasize that.
Okay, we have another phone question.
And our next question comes from the line of Steve Jordan with Omaha World Herald.
Yeah, if you can hear me, I'm kind of, I don't want to monopolize things, but I understand the answer to that. Are you saying that the that over time these rate increases on the individual marketplaces will stabilize and not be the up and downs, but particularly the ups that we've seen in the last few years, that they will stabilize after a period of time, and you might know when that may happen.
Well, I would think that they looking at sort of what was going on in the marketplaces, the first 2 years, the insurers were setting premiums without any real experience with who they were going to enroll and what their utilization and costs would be. It wasn't until the third year that they actually had some experience and could look to their own enrollment. And this was still a time when enrollment was growing and changing. Last year and this year were basically, and particularly this year, have been a time of correction where they decide where they've been able to look and say, we lost money in some places because we were charging premiums that are too low. And now they raise their premiums to be commensurate with the level of health that they expect in the marketplaces. Assuming enrollment continues to grow modestly and doesn't retreat a lot, and there's no reason to assume it will, but if it stays about where it is and grows modestly like we've seen the last 2 years, there's no reasons why large premium increases should continue. It should be more based on trend, which is low.
And this is Drew, and this is why in general the state regulators, the state insurance departments are approving the big premium increases where they're being proposed, because they understand that this is about readjusting or rebasing or stabilizing the market for the future. I don't think anyone knows whether that will take 1 year or 2 years, but that's what this next period is about. I think it will take increased enrollment, so that's an important caveat. How much is not an exact science and will vary around the country.
Okay, next question from Leslie Small. Do you have a sense of whether employees are largely embracing HDHPs or if the trend is driven more by employers looking to shift costs onto workers?
This is Gary. My sense is that employers make this move after they spend some time at least in telling their employees what is going to happen. And since employers do want to make health benefits that are attractive, they at least work to some extent to try to make these transitions as easy as possible. In general, I think the idea of higher cost sharing and employees taking more responsibility for their own decisions and health is where the employee benefits community is mostly, many of them believe that's the appropriate way, I think. So they believe in this approach. Whether or not employees will push back and sort of slow this down again, I don't know.
So this is Drew. I would give a slightly different answer. I think the employee perspective on this is a little different from the perspective you hear in the policy community, where in some quarters there is a genuine and deep belief in prudent purchasing, in high deductible plans, and in high deductible plans and savings accounts, and there has been for a long time. There's no great love, and actually we see this in the survey when we ask employers, you know, what their views are on different cost containment strategies for higher cost sharing as a strategy. But when you are an employer and you're trying to keep your premium down, you may be interested in a whole bunch of different cost containment strategies, and generally they are. And I am an employer. The only button that you can push that will, you know, immediately reduce the premium is to increase the deductible. And when you tie it to a savings account, that is a better and more forward thinking way to do it. So I don't actually believe in most cases it's out of any great love for the idea as a policy direction so much as just a pragmatic step they take, a dance they do and step they take annually to try and keep the rate of increase in the premium as low as they can.
And another question on high deductible health plans from Jenny Beam of the Houston Chronicle. Do you have data about the number of plans with deductibles in the 4K to 6K range?
We can figure that out for you if you loop back with us after the call.
All right. That has exhausted the questions, unless there are any last second ones. So I'm going to hand it over to Drew to wrap up.
Yeah, no, well, there were a lot of you this year, so thank you very much for your interest. Thank all the partners again, and we will be back with you again next year.